As Father Gary said, I'm teaching philosophy in our philosophy department at our school in Berkeley. And so that's also my approach to this topic. I'm not taking a theological approach or a more pious approach, perhaps. I'm really asking about the philosophical evaluation of the data, the evidence that we have, and the principles that go into that. And philosophy actually has more recently picked up on a lot of these topics. Philosophy of religion was pretty much dead for a long while. I mean, with logical positivism, and in the 40s and 50s, nobody would touch that. But it is big, it is back big times, basically. There are lots of journals for philosophy of religion, and they're doing topics that you would think are absolutely theological in nature. So the philosophy of, I mean, certainly there's faith and reason questions, there is the proofs of the existence of God, there's questions about theodicy, divine hiddenness, the afterlife, even atonement of all things. You wouldn't believe it that philosophers talk about that. But also philosophy of miracles. That's actually something that's, I think, just beginning. And so what I'm doing then is to look at that from purely from the viewpoint of reason rather than faith, although that will be involved in other ways. And it is obviously, I mean, a huge topic. There are a lot of side subjects, and it's a complex topic, and I cannot do everything tonight. But I will do go through a number of things, and basically there are two parts. First of all, I can actually write on this thing. I'm a little hesitant. Never done that before. So the first is about the possibility of miracles, you know, whether it's possible that miracles can happen, and what goes into that. And then the actuality of miracles. I don't know if you can read that from the back, but that is, sure, you can prove perhaps it's possible that miracles could happen, but do they happen? And if they happen, could we know it? And what would go into that? So we're looking at those two things. Now, the title of the topic, you know, whether it's rational to believe in miracles, indicates already a bit of a skeptical kind of outlook. And that, I think, is good to start from, because that's the age in which we live. People are skeptical about religious claims. And that's not an unhealthy thing, I think. It's all right. And but perhaps not so good is if people assume that matters of faith are just for superstitious or simple-minded persons. Or, as David Hume has it, the ignorant and barbarous people. So I hope that I can disperse tonight of that, if you think that. Other people think, well, it's because people were ignorant, and that's a matter for bygone ages. You know, in the past, you could still believe in miracles. Today, we know so much more about science, and so it's not rational anymore to believe in miracles. And in fact, that is not just limited to the secular world. Even theologians and scripture scholars sometimes say things like that. So, for example, Rudolf Bultmann, a German scripture scholar, better. So here is what Bultmann says. He says, it is impossible to use electric light and the wireless and to avail ourselves of modern medical and surgical discoveries and at the same time to believe in the New Testament world of spirits and miracles. So that is sort of what he proposes, but if you ask yourself, where's the argument here? I mean, it's more an expression of a bias than an argument. Why would it follow that knowing technology and science makes it impossible to believe in miracles? I'll actually try to show later that technology helps us to discover miracles. You know, this is just the opposite of what people think. And moreover, you know, if people in the time of Jesus would think that a virgin birth is a miracle, they knew perfectly well that scientifically and on laws of nature, it's impossible. You know? Otherwise, they wouldn't call it a miracle. We don't need to wait for contemporary science to tell us that. That's implied. Mm-hmm. And so that we have now all this science does not imply that we have to give up on that. There are a few more chairs here. There are two here, one here, and one in the middle there. So you don't have to stand in the back. Don't be shy. you know, Hegel the philosopher, you know, whatever you think of him, I mean, he astutely did observe that, in fact, it takes a rational age that has the notion of laws of nature to even believe in miracles or have a concept of miracles. You know? So to have that does not speak against miracles, that is actually presupposed. So, but that is perhaps an illustration of how it might look like from the modern age and from the eyes of the unbelievers. Now we can also ask, how does it look like from the side of the believers? It's not as clear as you might think. So let's take the viewpoint of a Christian, and to make it even more concrete, perhaps a Catholic Christian. First of all, for Christianity, it's important to point out that there's probably no religion for which miracles are more important than Christianity. We don't typically realize that. This is not just a side aspect or an esoteric kind of thing. Miracles are at the very heart of what we believe. Why? Because our faith is based on a miracle, the miracle of the resurrection. What is the resurrection there for? What are miracles in general there for? They are meant to authenticate teaching and religious truth claims. So even in the Old Testament, prophets work miracles to say the message that I have is really from God, and here I show you, because I do something only God can do, you know, with the help of God, like Elijah or something. And that is true for Jesus as well. So Jesus had his public ministry. He proclaimed his identity in so many ways that he was the Son of God, that he was indeed God. And that, you know, you cannot even reduce, as C.S. Lewis rightly points out, to saying he was just a wise man or pretended just to be a good teacher. No, he claimed to be the Son of God. If you claim that, you're either mad or a deceiver, you know, or it is true what you are saying, right? But that Jesus rose from the dead is basically demonstrating that he truly was who he claimed to be, namely God. Because resurrection cannot happen on any other kind of account, which would be, we could make a whole talk about that. It's just to illustrate right now that for Christianity that is central. You cannot cut that out and keep Christianity. So this is a very important topic then. But it does make then also Christianity more vulnerable to such criticisms. You know? So we have to be aware of that. So Christianity has to have a strong claim about this. On the other hand, you also find a very strong skepticism within Christianity with regard to miracles. So, for example, the Catholic Church, if somebody claims a miracle, be it an apparition or Eucharistic miracle, or some locutions, or canonization processes, you know, for which you also need miracles, all of that will be very critically investigated. And to take the example of the healings in Lourdes in France, you know, people estimate there are tens of thousands of healings that have happened, but the church only acknowledged, well, I have a number that says 67, there might be a few more by now, but not many more. It's a very, very small percentage that the church will officially acknowledge. And how does the church do that? They take scientists to investigate that, boards, independent boards of scientists and doctors, among whom are atheists. Atheists that are not paid. So it's important, you know, so that they try to take away any incentive, you know, to collaborate with the system. And these atheists are willing to go so far as to say that here is something we cannot scientifically explain anymore in any physical kind of way. That doesn't mean that they become Catholic or Christians, yeah? But they're willing to say that. That's good evidence. So whatever we think about that, it's just to illustrate, this is a case of faith and reason. So the church says we need an independent viewpoint that does not already presuppose the faith to look at that. So if miracles are meant to authenticate the faith, then believing in miracles cannot already depend on the faith. miracles for that purpose must be visible to the naked eye, if you want, the one that doesn't have yet the vision of faith. It must be visible to the philosopher, the atheist, scientist, and so forth. And so that's what I'm looking at right now, whether it is rational from that perspective to accept that. Now, if you're talking about the possibility of miracles, there are more principled kind of objections people make on a metaphysical scale. You know, should we even think that even a Christian God would or could work miracles? Maybe that's metaphysically impossible. You know, God might be contradicting himself and so forth and so on. In order to illustrate that a bit, let me give you an example. So let's say you have a little boy playing on the train tracks. And on comes this high-speed train, you know, and you can predict there he is. He's playing, totally oblivious, and the train is coming closer and closer and closer. And suddenly the train comes to a screeching halt, you know, and stopping 5 centimeters, you know, close to the boy. A miracle, you know, he has been saved, right? And so the mother comes running and so forth, and says, oh, this is a miracle, and she thanks God. Now, upon closer inspection, it turns out that the driver of the train sort of passed out and let the lever go, you know, that kept the train going. And so the train came to a halt exactly at that point where it needed to stop for the boy to be saved. Now, is that a miracle or not? Well, I think the mother will learn about that and will still thank God. God can work miracles of a certain sort by coincidence. No laws of nature are broken here. Everything is explainable. And even the atheist will be able to explain everything that there is. That doesn't mean that God couldn't be at work at that. It doesn't mean that the mother doesn't have reasons to thank God, you know, even after the discovery. However, that cannot be the only miracles that God works. These are miracles of what we would call special providence. Why is that not the only one? Well, if miracles are meant to authenticate the faith, you will not convince the atheist by that. The atheist will just say, well, that's just a coincidence, right? I mean, it doesn't prove anything, right? And that the mother is excited about it is completely understandable and can be explained psychologically and so forth. Of course she is. And haven't we always said that faith is just about wishful thinking and it's just your subjective projection on the objective scientific data that can be explained by science? So again, I think the mother is still right to thank God, but it doesn't give the non-believer enough evidence to believe that something really has happened here where God is involved. Now there are, however, theologians even who say that's the only thing God will do. So maybe you have heard the name Paul Tillich, the Protestant. Black, yeah. Who would say that God would not even do that for theological reasons? Because if God were to break the laws of nature, he would contradict himself. Didn't God make nature and the laws of nature and so forth? I mean, he wills one thing, then he wills another, and that's a contradiction. And so he literally says that would make God into some kind of an absurd or schizophrenic or even demonic God. And miracles would be just mere absurdities that destroy the rational structure of reality. Now, I hope to show a little bit further that is not something one has to think. It's, if anything, the opposite. I think it does at least point out the importance of what miracles might do. So Tillich, if you ask me, was a bit of a pantheist. And for pantheists, that's a typical position to hold. Another important pantheist who says exactly that is Spinoza. I forgot that name from the 17th century. Who also said, I mean, miracles are impossible. They're just subjective projections, like the mother who's excited, you know? And you get your imagination going. But if you come down to the ultimate level of reality and understanding that, you know it's all this one substance, which is God, and God is a necessary being, and everything in God is necessarily as it is, just as 2 plus 2 equals 4. Nothing can change about that. And therefore, God cannot work miracles. God would have to change himself. But how is a necessary being going to change himself? Right? You would have not to only break the laws of nature, God has to break himself. So that wouldn't work. But, and that's true if you're a pantheist. No. But it's important to see that, because then you see in the reverse, if there are miracles, we cannot be pantheists. If there are miracles, then laws of nature exist because God made them, and he chose to make them, and he can choose to make them otherwise if he wants. God transcends nature. God transcends the whole universe. He is not identical with it. And he is sovereign. He is the Lord. He can say, can be A or non-A. You know, there are certain things, you know, he cannot change, like 2 plus 2 is 4, I would say that. But the laws of nature are not of that sort. We can easily imagine a cosmos with different laws of nature. They depend on God's choice. And if you then have a miracle, that shows you that that laws of nature are not necessary. They depend on God's choice just as the miracle depends on God's choice. God can make the laws and therefore also unmake the laws. Doesn't mean that he's doing that arbitrarily, but it does mean that he is in charge. He transcends nature, and there is some things that are for him to change. That makes for a very different view of reality. You know? So you expect that things may change. It's against sort of this view that there's nothing new under the sun. In the book of Qoheleth, that sounds pretty bleak, you know. But God actually can make something new. And also, I mean, it tells you really something about who God is. That's what I'm trying to say. God is a personal God. God is someone who is not like a mechanism. It's not like the laws of nature. You know, Spinoza, so God is a big mechanism. There's no choice. God doesn't have choices for Spinoza at all. God is like a blind mechanism or a supercomputer or something like that. No, God has choices. God has reasons for his choices. He has purposes that he pursues. He is a person. And one place where that comes out is our prayer life. Now, if we pray, we expect that God actually can respond to our prayers. We expect that we are in a personal engagement with God, a dialogue where there is give and take. So, and that's of course especially true if I pray for a miracle. Right? So if your aunt is in the hospital with cancer and you pray for her healing, then you believe by that very fact that God can do something about it. Otherwise, your prayer is pretty useless. So there's a lot that hinges on that. And so whether God can work miracles or not, and it's our very idea of who God is that that is at stake here. And so, but even within, you know, science and physics, you can take that and look at, for example, what people say about the Big Bang. You know, if you look at the very beginning of the universe, that must be like a miracle. The Big Bang didn't come about by the laws of nature, because there were no laws of nature. There was nothing, right? That must have, as its cause, a God who not only decides that the universe should exist, but also that it would have these laws. So that's actually a good analog for what a miracle might be. And again, God could have made the universe at a different time with different laws, you know, in different setups, you know. So it's the same God who works miracles who also makes the laws of nature. There's no contradiction in that. So therefore, I guess also, now let's leave that for a moment. So, but what could we then say? What are miracles if we are looking for a definition of that? St. Augustine says this. He says, a miracle is something difficult which seldom occurs, exceeding the faculty of nature, and so far surpassing our hopes as to compel astonishment. There are a lot of elements in that. There's an element of astonishment, obviously, you know, but I think important here is something that exceeds the faculty of nature. I think that's a better formulation than saying God breaks nature. That would make it sound like a contradiction in some way. But it is nature doing some things that it couldn't do on its own. It's like a supernatural elevation of nature. So if you take the case of levitation, right? Let's assume that, that such a thing exists. That's not breaking laws of nature, but it allows a physical object to work against the laws of gravity, which it normally cannot do. You can say it's against gravity, but it's also an empowerment, if you want. You know, it's lifting it, literally lifting it up in this case. And with that, it's, as Richard of St. Victor says, a work of the Creator, manifestive of divine power. Or another formulation, perhaps, an event inexplicable by natural forces and implying supernatural agency. So, this is, first of all, just to say, in that account, there is no contradiction in claiming miracles, therefore they are possible. They are also, they're physically and logically possible. We can discuss that further, but I hope that sort of puts that at rest, first of all. Now, what has been discussed more in the modern age is the actuality of miracles. And the most famous person to raise that question is David Hume. Although he was not the only one and not even the first one, I think he gets a bit too much credit there. People have shown that in the meanwhile. But David Hume is making some skeptical arguments that people have discussed ever since. And David Hume was what we call an empiricist. So somebody who just works from the empirical observable sense data and so forth. And I mean, he does not claim that God could not violate the laws of nature because he didn't get very far with laws of nature to begin with. If you're just observing empirical data, he would claim you cannot even observe anything like causality, let alone laws of nature. We do observe certain regularities, you know, and we call that laws of nature, but that's a very weak form of necessity for causal processes in nature. So for him to say that the violation of the laws of nature is impossible would be too strong of a claim, and that's in fact not the argument that he makes. He would say it's not that it's impossible, it's just if it has happened, we could never know it. And why? David Hume says, a wise man always balances his beliefs based on the evidence. And if you look at the scales of evidence here, well, the laws of nature we know from how things always happen all the time. I mean, the law of gravity, just by the fact that you're sitting on your chair, you're affirming the law of gravity, right? We don't usually acknowledge that, but it's true. You know, I mean, throughout of our life, we rely on the laws of nature, and our whole life is giving evidence to that. You know? So we have lots of evidence for the laws of nature. Now, if a miracle comes along, that's a very isolated kind of case. You know? So you just have a little evidence there, perhaps if at all. And if we weigh that and say, well, should we assume that, no, this is not really a miracle, but actually explicable by the laws of nature, then we have all the evidence for the laws of nature here and a little bit of evidence here for miracles. And he would say that totally swamps all the evidence for miracles, and therefore, even if we had something like that, it was the most rational thing to believe that it hasn't happened. Now, just to make that a little worse, some of the cases, or many actually of them, are already in the past. And so we have to rely on historical testimony for our belief in them. So just take the resurrection. You know, we know it from the Gospels, we know it from the testimony that has been handed down to the apostles and so forth and so on. So even if these documentary witnesses are trustworthy, which Hume denies, they always provide less evidence in favor of the miracles than the laws that they break. And this point has been reinforced by Anthony Flew. Do you remember Anthony Flew, the atheist? He had a bit of a conversion at the end of his life, although not to Christianity. So he reinforces Hume's skeptical argument by making this historical point. You know, so he says, scientific laws you can test here and now. You know, can always make more experiments. But something in the past is in principle inaccessible to the laboratory. And so that makes it worse. Moreover, you cannot repeat the evidence because it is a unique event. It's a one historical event. So that makes it look pretty bleak. You know, and even if we test it, then we have to rely on the laws of nature to give us the evidence from the past. And so he says, our sole ground for characterizing a reported occurrence as miraculous is at the same time a sufficient reason for calling it physically impossible. So that's the case against miracles here. So why should we think that they're both wrong? Let me show you. So the first argument one might make, and there are quite a few who have made that argument, is that Hume overstates his case. I mean, that's just a matter of his formulation. He says, you know, there is uniform experience against every miraculous event. He shouldn't have said that. If you say there's uniform evidence against miracles, that's begging the question. You know, we just don't know that. You know, and if you say that, you have no proof for it. But if you say that, of course, you have begged the question against miracles in the first place. And that's exactly the question, and we should look at the evidence whether that's true or not. So but you know, you might even add, you know, that the experience is not as uniform as he claims. There's a whole two-volume book by an evangelical Craig Keener, who is amassing all these kind of things across the world and Africa and so forth, how much the miraculous is part of the life of so many people. It's only just a little enclave in the West, you know, the ivory tower of Western academics who are so skeptical about that, you know. So only for them it seems uniform, but it isn't really if you go out into the world. Now, be that as it may, I would say let's grant him that. You know, I mean, it wouldn't grant the uniformity, but you know, so that's just a weak formulation, and that's the argument doesn't really hinge on that. After all, it is true, even if it's not uniform, the miracle is always more rare than the evidence for the laws of nature. That's by definition, you know. In one case you have laws, in the other one you have an exception. It cannot be otherwise. My first point would rather be that individual experiences as such do count. You cannot just say, well, there's all this evidence and therefore we should discount individual experiences. They are important. And especially Hume, who is an empiricist, cannot rule that out because that's all that you have. And so if that is so, if there's no contradiction between the evidence for laws of nature and the miraculous, then you should look at the evidence. That is, you should not discard the evidence, but investigate it. That's the more reasonable thing to do. Improbable things, and that's all that you can claim that it is, improbable things, after all, do happen. Winning in the lottery is possible, too, and people do win, and there's evidence for it, you know. And if Hume were right, then there couldn't be any, even within the process of science, there couldn't be any progress. So you might think you have discovered a law of nature. And people claim that a lot in the past, including outdated forms of natural science, where people found what they call so-called recalcitrant cases. So you have these laws of nature, but there are certain things that just don't fit. Now you can say, well, we have the law of nature, just dismiss that, right? That would be the analog of what David Hume is suggesting. But you actually might come to find out that maybe your law of nature isn't really what it was. Maybe you have to revise your scientific hypothesis and propose a different law that takes that additional evidence into account. And that's how progress in science usually happens. Now for Hume, such recalcitrant evidence is a priori to be dismissed. He indicates at one point a prince in faraway India who hears for the first time of the phenomenon of frost, unknown in his own climate, should rightly dismiss such evidence as a mere fairy tale. Is that rational? And so perhaps we also should have dismissed the first reports of black swans in Australia as mere superstition, you know, or even as an attempt as malicious deception. But if so, then we would have never been able to change our mind about it. And we did. Nor, more generally, would we have been able to test and falsify current paradigms. Now, being pressed on this point, Hume might still answer that if indeed the evidence adds up, then he would be willing to surrender the paradigm and to change something. The problem with that suggestion, though, is that on his own theory, this adding up of evidence could never happen. For all those instances that could add up are to be dismissed, simply because they are individual cases. And if each individual case is dismissed, then all are dismissed. Mere zeros do not add up to anything. In sum, they remain zero. Still, let us cut Hume even more slack. Let us grant for him, for the sake of argument, that the individual cases could indeed add up. Even so, do we even have to wait for the evidence to add up? Hume would require us to wait for so much evidence that it would trump the cumulative evidence for our previous paradigm. And I don't think that is necessary. Consider the possibility of coming across a recalcitrant case, some one piece of evidence that all by itself suggests to us a paradigm shift. It might not by itself be enough evidence to confirm a new paradigm. But I do not think that confirmation is required. It was Karl Popper, the philosopher of science, who says that paradigms and hypotheses do not need to be confirmed in order to be acceptable scientific theories. They only need to be falsifiable. So you can say, here I have the recalcitrant case. Here is a theory that explains it better. I might not have all the data, but here it is now for us to test, you know, and it's rational for me to assume that that is true. And I can show you under which conditions it's falsifiable. If a recalcitrant case leads us to propose a new theory, including one that suggests a supernatural cause, then it is not irrational to accept it. Rather, it is possible to state the conditions under which the new paradigm would be falsified, and it is rational to then proceed and investigate it empirically. In addition, it is very important to realize that against Hume's crucial assumption, the recalcitrant new evidence for the new paradigm does not have to outweigh the old. So it does not mean we have here all the evidence for law of nature and here a little bit for miracles, and that has to outweigh that. That's actually the crucial mistake, I think. The reason is that there is no contradiction between the new paradigm and the evidence for the old paradigm. It is the aim of the new paradigm to explain not only the new evidence, but also the old. Hence, in a scientific shift, a new paradigm, the new paradigm will indeed explain even the old evidence better and more comprehensively than the old paradigm. And if it does so, then all the old evidence that Hume claims speaks against the new paradigm now speaks, in fact, for it. So I think that the whole question is misconceived there. So if we have a new paradigm that explains everything better, It explains also the old evidence better, and its evidence now for the new paradigm, not against it. Now, is that true also for miracles? Miracles are, after all, unique and peculiar. They do not amount to evidence for a new law of nature. They are still defined by contrast to such laws. Nevertheless, there's a way in which they too can establish a new paradigm. Consider someone who is converted by witnessing a miracle. And so as to go to the heart of the matter, consider the apostles being confronted with the risen Jesus. The gospel narratives illustrate what such a paradigm might look like, how the evidence for the resurrection might take time to sink in, or there can be even an initial dismissal of the evidence. Yet at the end, it does indeed produce a new outlook. Is that shift irrational because it contradicts our previous evidence? No, because in this new outlook, all the old evidence also looks different. The old evidence will not contradict the new paradigm, but it is suddenly evident what the old evidence meant all the way along. This is true particularly for the previous religious experience and all the evidence that could be adduced for the faith of ancient Israel. But the new paradigm will also include the evidence for the regular and ordinary behavior of nature and its laws. Having come to know God as someone who reveals himself in extraordinary events in history would not have led the apostles to disbelieve in a God who orders the ordinary course of nature according to predictable laws. In fact, it is the same care that leads God to reveal himself, which also motivates him to provide for us laws of nature that make our environment sufficiently predictable and intelligible. Evidence for laws of nature are not evidence against miracles, rather they are just more evidence for the same God who also works miracles. So Richard Swinburne has made that point. You shouldn't expect that there are laws of nature. That's a whole another question. That's actually surprising that there is order. But the God who works miracles is one who expresses that he is a personal God who cares for how we are doing. He knows that we need revelation, we need help. And it's the same God who in his benevolence gives us the laws of nature that makes nature predictable and allows us to survive. And makes nature, even the laws of nature even in such a way that that they're on this, the kind of range that we live in. So there's no contradiction there. In fact, it is just highlighted by the new evidence. They form one paradigm that explains all at once much better. So contrary to Hume, nothing in this faith is irrational, and nothing in miracles requires us to dismiss any evidence. Rather, it is David Hume who needs to dismiss the given evidence dogmatically and a priori. Now, what about the historical argument of Anthony Flew? After all, we are not the apostles. We are not eyewitnesses to the resurrection. We live 2,000 years later and have to rely on documents that others might call into doubt. I will not engage the specific case of the resurrection here, although one can make a surprisingly good case, actually, for the evidence of the resurrection. But that would be a whole talk of its own. I just want to look at the principles that are involved here. Now, with regard to history, there is a common misunderstanding that has to do with yet another thinker, Ernst Troeltsch.
Lots of Germans here. It's supposed to be L.
Protestant theologian. He formulated the so-called principle of analogy. According to that principle, we cannot assume that the past was not analogous to the present. So if we don't experience miracles today, we shouldn't assume that they have happened in the past. And that means the historical method as such would in principle be restricted to non-miraculous events. Yet that, I think, is not true. What this principle of analogy can reasonably mean only is that we should evaluate testimony from the past in the same way as we evaluate testimony from the present. Put in this way, the analogy is not an analogy between past and present events, but an analogy of the methods to be employed in the investigation of events. So, for one, any kind of historical event is unique. Richard Niebuhr has pointed that out, Reinhold Niebuhr rather. If it is unique, what does an analogy mean? The same event doesn't happen today. Should we dismiss that it happens? No. It's not a matter of the events that happen. They could be totally disanalogous. They are, by the very fact that they're historical and unique. No, but we do investigate it with the same principles, analogous principles that we would use today. So if somebody today claims a miracle, we might test that person or about certain psychological conditions or whether that person might have taken drugs or something like that. And so if we could show that in the past the apostles were on drugs or had hallucinations, that would be a proper application of the principle of analogy, not what the apostles claim happened. That's not what the method can make any claims about. But the way we assess the evidence, that should be analogous. And that cuts both ways. If in some way we can show that there's nothing in the case of the apostles that would lead us to believe that they had hallucinations or were on drugs or whatever, you know, then we should also believe the evidence and not dismiss it. You know? So, but that's a point that has often been made, and I think it's important to get that out of the way, first of all. So it's an analogy of method, not of content. And that still would allow for all the critical analysis of historical evidence, obviously. And again, we could say, you know, I mean, we think that miracles don't happen today and therefore we should dismiss them in the past, but that already assumes that they don't happen, and there is actually a lot of evidence that this is even today the case. So I think that's also important to acknowledge. So let's say, therefore, that doesn't exclude that miracles happen. But what about whether they actually did happen? Can we show that? What are those analogous methods that allow us to establish the actuality of a miracle in history? Anthony Flew maintains that as a unique and past event, it cannot be scientifically tested. This, however, is not true, for the very reason to which Anthony Flew actually appeals. He correctly insists that our interpretation of the detritus of the past requires us to assume that the laws of nature are operative in order for us to be able to extrapolate to past events. But is it true that we can therefore never access an event that is not itself an expression of these laws? So if you want to trace something back, you know, say by archaeological methods, you know, to the past, then you assume that your machines and your data and whatever you're using in that case, you know, is operating to a certain kind of established scientific laws, and that gives you the evidence. So Anthony Flew would say, well, you presume that it's working, and at the same time you're claiming it's broken in the miracle. Well, that actually works the other way around, as I will show in a moment. But first of all, to give you an example where that is actually the case, that's the Big Bang that I just mentioned earlier. The Big Bang is a unique historical event of the past that cannot itself today be replicated or tested in a laboratory. So it would be like what Anthony Flew says about historical evidence. And this evidence is certainly far more distant in the past than all miracles ever reported, including the resurrection. And there were not even any eyewitnesses for it, like the apostles. And at the Big Bang, presumably neither time nor space nor the laws of nature existed. It is a unique event that has all the marks of a miracle, that is, of a supernatural initiative by a non-physical agent. And yet, we know about the event only by virtue of tracing things back from contemporary evidence along the laws of nature that we know. How do we know about the Big Bang? We look at what the world is today and we trace it back by the known laws of nature. This means that we use a scientific method involving a principle of analogy, and the method leads us back precisely to a non-analogous, unique historical event. So that's not impossible, that's what we do, that's what science says. Now, can we apply such methods to miracles? What might help us here is something David Hume didn't know anything about: the modern methods of criminology and scientific forensic investigations. As Richard Swinburne points out, Hume did not take into account physical traces such as can be left on a crime scene: cigarette ashes, bomb craters, fingerprints, or pollen. In addition, we have methods of radiocarbon dating, dendrochronology, archaeological methods, and so forth. And so all of these allow us to gather evidence about something from the past. Just to give you, let me say that first. So it allows us to gather scientific evidence about historical events. The interesting point is that this evidence about the past is present evidence. If you look at present artifacts and things, what you have right now, and you can put them under the microscope, you can put them in the laboratory. And the evidence is observable now under the microscope and other testing devices, and as such it can also be subjected to repeated testing. And indeed, the church has had such tests applied to the Shroud of Turin, or Our Lady of Guadalupe, the Tomb of Saint Juan Diego, with surprising things. I mean, that would be, again, another topic. I'm not trying to do this right now, but there is quite amazing things that they've discovered that way. Contrary to it, that is science telling us that, right? It's not against science, it's science itself that allows us to see that evidence for the first time. So contrary to Anthony Flew, there are repeatable experiments that we can make about the past, and we can repeat these experiments potentially indefinitely. In this manner, sufficient evidence can easily accumulate. Moreover, I do not think that proving a miracle is a mere matter of cumulative probability. So even if you can repeat this, it's not actually necessary to, you know, do it so much that we have more evidence that might not even work. That would already concede too much to David Hume, because that's not the point in the first place. It's a matter of these paradigm shifts that I talked about earlier, and not there's not weighing one against the other. The testing scenario suggests something rather different than weighing or adding up of evidence. But David Hume says, no testimony is sufficient to establish a miracle unless the testimony be of such a kind that its falsehood would be more miraculous than the fact which it endeavors to establish. And I think exactly that is the case, but in a different way than David Hume thinks. What if those testing devices show us evidence for a miracle? For example, a microscope applied to the Shroud of Turin, or the film of Our Lady of Guadalupe, or whatever it is. If that testing device gives us that evidence, then we can dismiss the evidence only on the supposition that a miracle has instead occurred in the testing device. So, if you want to say, let's just do this.
Let's hope this one works here.
So let's say, oh yeah, good. Yeah. So that's the timeline, and let's say here is where your ordinary course of events happens in nature, you know, operates according to laws of nature and so forth. But then here something happens, right? So we're going to call it violation of laws of nature or whatever, you know, something that's not explicable. And you do observe that through some testing device. You know, let's say that's something like a microscope or telescope. And here are you, here's your eye. You know, and you're looking through that. And you see evidence for this disruption here that doesn't obey the laws of nature here. Now you can say, that didn't happen. You know, as David Hume would say, that the laws of nature were always in place. Well, then what happened here? Something must be wrong here. But in order for something to be wrong here, there must be a miracle happening in the testing device. No, David Hume says then, well, but that never adds up to all the evidence we have for all the laws of nature here. But no, these are the same laws of nature that are operative here. And the very fact that you have to choose one or the other means a miracle has happened, either here or there. Right? You don't have to weigh anything. Nothing has to add up. It's just that very fact that you're confronted with that quandary. That itself is evidence for a miracle. Regardless of whether the laws of nature are broken in the observed event or the testing device, it is a miracle. Even and precisely if it is a draw between the two, it is a miracle. This is important because this insight is applicable beyond the methods of forensic criminology or other kinds of scientific methods. It does, for example, apply to the classic case of eyewitnesses. For what is the eye if not a testing device? You could take that away and say, it's just you looking at that. The eye operates according to a neurophysiological kind of laws and physical laws as well. Laws of optics, perhaps, and so forth. And even if someone is deceived under certain ideal conditions, then we should still have to conclude that a miracle has occurred in the eye itself. And this, too, can be tested. And so people do that, for example. So, I mean, there are people going into ecstasy and having apparitions and so forth, and they're looking at the eye. They're testing the eye and, you know, testing whether the eye reacts to something and so forth. So you can look at that, you know. Whatever you think about the evidence there, but that's a rational kind of procedure. You know? And if you cannot explain this away or that away, I mean, you are just then stuck with the case of a miracle, I think. And so we can test that, and we can test it repeatedly, and so forth. If we were to dismiss this kind of evidence, we would have to dismiss our very evidence for the laws of nature as well. For we test the laws of nature with the same kind of devices. The ultimate devices available to us are our five senses, conveying sense experience to us by organs like the eye. Any evidence against the witness of our own eyes can only consist in additional sense experience of the same kind, and therefore rely on the same kinds of methods about which we pretend to be skeptical. So all of our evidence is working in that way, and so if we want to dismiss evidence for laws of for miracles that way, we would also get rid of all the other ones. This includes also the eyewitnesses of the historical past, of which Hume and many others tend to be dismissive. Witnesses are, as they are treated in court, are just another sort of testing device. They might be broken devices indeed, but they nevertheless follow laws of their own that allow us to evaluate the evidence. Accordingly, no court dismisses his eyewitnesses just because they are eyewitnesses. They do not dismiss them, but they evaluate their testimony. The methods of this evaluation are not unlike those that are used to establish the proper functioning of other kinds of tests and devices, for the behavior of witnesses has its own laws and regularities that enable us to assess the claims that are made. These regularities are not in principle different from those of the laws of nature because they are established in the same way. In both cases, such regularities provide the most simple and coherent account of a large number of observed data, the data here being the behavior of the witnesses. To treat regularities about witnesses differently than regularities of nature would be an unwarranted ad hoc procedure for assessing evidence. So, for example, one of the established regularities about witnesses is that it is difficult for a liar to keep his story straight. The first German chancellor after the war, Konrad Adenauer, said, "I never lie. My memory is not good enough." You always have to think, what did I just say? Does it fit the story I'm telling? If you're just telling the truth, it takes care of itself because reality is consistent by its very nature. So it's hard for a liar to keep his story straight. At a certain point, it would require an almost miraculous power of presence of mind and memory to do so. Still, it might be possible. But suppose we add to this the fact that multiple independent witnesses are consistent in telling the same miraculous story. Let's say, a miracle story. Then the assumption of a lie, or the assumption that all of them are lying independently, making up the same story consistently, would constitute a coincidence more miraculous than assuming that they are speaking the truth. Had the miracle not occurred as reported or observed, then their agreement would itself be a miracle, just as it would be in the testing devices in our previous cases. So that's in principle, a possible testing procedure, and eyewitness is not just a matter of subjectivity. that's, you know, we can also, of course, test whether they are of doubtful character, but that actually isn't even the point. They can be very fallible morally, they can be very dubious and shady characters, you know, they can be ignorant, they can be epistemologically fallible, and so forth. All of that is already built into the laws here, you know. Let's say, especially if somebody is a crook, you know, he can predict what he's going to do, or how he might be bribed, or what kind of interests he might be pursuing, and so forth. It doesn't depend on the upright moral character. You know. I mean, that can also help, depending on the case at hand, but it really, you don't have to rely on subjective honesty or something here. The laws are in place anyway, and the police is working with it all the time. And you can do further things, you know, whether the statements are compatible, whether the agreement could have a special motivation, whether they speak with hesitation or too assertively or have vested interests, and whether they happen to uphold their testimony even under torture and threat of death. Now, with the testimony for the resurrection, the apostles, all of them, were willing to die for it. Nobody broke, you know, said, oh, we were all made that up and something like that. You know. And explain that. You know, that's actually pretty good evidence right there too. But again, that would be part of a larger case, say, for the evidence for the resurrection in particular. You know, just to say that though, I mean, that the apostles would be willing to do that is itself testimony to the resurrection, because you would only do that if you believe in your own resurrection based on what you have witnessed. And that's the only reason for them to do believe that. You know? So some of the evidence thus generated might only produce probabilities, but in many cases, assuming the opposite would lead to real impossibilities. Scientists who would want to question the rigor of these criteria might do well to consider the procedures of their own disciplines and how much of their own evidence relies on the truthful testimony of other members of the scientific community. Let me say one more point here, just to zero out. All of this does not even take into account further background knowledge by which we might approach these data. There might be independent philosophical, not theological or faith reasons, philosophical reasons to believe that God exists. That's philosophical theism. It's not Christianity or Islam or anything in specific. You might, on scientific grounds and other philosophical grounds, say it is rational for me and the only way for me to explain certain things that God exists, independently from miracles. Right? And perhaps that this God is almighty and benevolent, that he cares about us. Now, if that is the case, then miracles are not that unlikely at all. The leap is not as big as more anymore as if you're David Hume. Now, you can say, well, that's assuming a whole lot. But that's maybe not unlike what other people assume about science and the presupposition of the laws of nature. These laws of nature are also not observable in the particular kind of evidence that you're looking at. They're the larger framework under which you operate, the larger story that you tell yourself about reality and existence and the meaning of it, or in the midst of it. And all of these enter in some what people call the prior probability of certain events. So if you are an atheist or a pantheist, you know, based on the story you tell yourself, of course, you will say the prior probability of miracles is nil. But that depends on your presuppositions. Now, why would it be so illegitimate to assume that God exists? Pantheism and monotheism are on a par in that way. And I would say there's actually, on top of that, very good reasons to think that God exists. Reasons that are not based on faith already, but on indeed reason alone. So I think that's important to see that one shouldn't and cannot, Hume cannot just simply reject all of that and say you must not allow that, basically. Why would that be the case? I don't think that is a rational assumption. It's rather an artificial suppression of evidence. For moreover, if the very laws of nature that Hume and others appeal to as evidence against miracles are indeed dependent on the very existence of such a god, then these laws themselves cease to be evidence against miracles and instead come to support them. I'd indicate that before. I mean, I could certainly make a longer case about that. But all of this can be known on philosophical grounds, and it allows for the use of scientific methods, or else it is presupposed by these methods. So what you arrive at is a god who explains both. If you don't believe in a god who can work miracles, you have no reason to believe in the laws of nature. And if you believe in the laws of nature, there's a lot of things that you implicitly assume that imply the existence of God. Another case to be made for that. But it's just to show that there are a lot more background assumptions going into this, into the evaluation of actual cases of miracles, that you should take into account in the law and not allow other people to rule out. You know? So, and in that sense, I mean, I have to end here because I think we are running out of time, but I think it is rational to believe in miracles. The further arguments to be engaged, you can raise the questions now in the Q&A, but I think that might be a good place for me to stop right now. Are there any questions? Yes.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. I come from a family that has a lot of science-minded people in it.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all raised in the church, but I'm the only one who's a believer at this point. And one of the arguments that comes up always is one of rational or reasonable, you know, irrational. Well, the fact is, even at the base core of science are leaps of faith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you know, if the logic of if P then Q, I always say P should stand for premise, Q should stand for question. If your premise is this, then your question is that.
Uh-huh.
And if I don't share the same premise with someone,
mm-hmm.
then everything I say or do or think is irrational to them.
Yeah.
You can only have a discussion or an argument where the word rationale comes up
mm-hmm.
if you agree at the beginning to agree on a premise.
Yeah.
Because if you don't agree on the premise, if my premise is there is a God, and this other person's premise is there is no God,
yeah.
everything I say will be irrational to them. But everything I say in my own thinking is absolutely, completely rational.
Yeah. And that's why I preface the actuality question with the possibility question, because that's usually where that comes up. So, I mean, that was more the case about, you know, pantheism and Spinoza and so forth. But certainly you can, on that level, also argue with naturalism, as people call naturalism, that, you know, the natural world is all that there is. That's the whole show, basically. And there is no transcendent God who could interfere, basically. And C.S. Lewis, I don't know if you know C.S. Lewis's book on miracles. It's his most philosophical book and a really good book. But in the first chapters, he is addressing precisely that question. In that, he is trying to show that naturalism in itself is a self-refuting position. Because he knows that he has to clarify the premises from which to begin. I mean, on the premises of naturalism, miracles would not be rational. But you can show that it's actually not rational to be a naturalist. You know?
I want to add one thing else. You did mention prayer, which I thought was absolutely essential to mention.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing that, from the Christian point of view, not only miracles, but angels and miracles. I mean, honest to God, Christians believe in that there are spiritual realms.
Mm-hmm.
If you talk to a materialist, there are no spiritual realms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my own father went from being raised in the church and so forth to becoming someone who was an absolute materialist. And he, you know, came to me one day and said, there is no spirit, there is no soul. Possibly is no mind unless there is some substance
mm-hmm.
that is definable of
mm-hmm.
the mind. And so the person who's the materialist, unfortunately, in the main case is the scientist, though I don't think you have to be a materialist necessarily to be a scientist, are people who absolutely reject the notion of angels and,
yeah, all
and
of these
spiritual
are,
realm.
All of these are cases where something transcends the material, physical, natural realm. But it begins in us. And that's, in a way, C.S. Lewis's point. So free will, right? Free will also would not be compatible with the laws of nature if they are what David Hume says they are, right? Now, if you don't have free will, where does that leave you as a scientist? Now, C.S. Lewis does not even argue about free will. He's even arguing about the ability of the scientist to make, to propose his theory. What a scientist needs to, the theory that the scientist makes cannot be itself the outcome of these laws of nature and determined by it. They can determine both false and true outcomes. They don't adjudicate it. Anyway, that would be a longer case to make. But just to say, these are all cases, and it begins there, where something transcends nature. And we do indeed assume that even in ordinary life, when we act, when we pursue plans and purposes and so forth. The angel question would arise about at the time where I left off right now. People usually don't get to that question, right? So what you might show up to this point, and there's certainly more subpoints to be fleshed out, but you might show, like, let's say, the atheist physicist in Lourdes, you know, that there is something that's physically inexplicable. That is, there is something that needs explanation, but no physical cause is available. At that point, the only causes that you have available are spiritual causes. And those are of different kinds. There's more than one kind. That question doesn't typically arise in contemporary discussions, but there could be finite spiritual agents or infinite spiritual agents like God. And the tradition distinguishes between minor and major miracles. Minor miracles are those that angels can work. So, for example, levitation. The church would never use levitation in a canonization case, for example. Because a finite spiritual agent, like an angel, can do that too, but also the other side, right? So if the devil can do that, basically. So you have to take that into account. Again, this is not a question typically that arises in the secular sphere. I mean, but after that is settled, you still have to evaluate what's going on. And that can be of two kinds, the evaluation. So for one, if you're looking at spiritual agents, their causality is based on intentions, purposes, beliefs, and so forth. And they are typically outlined not by laws of nature, but by narratives. Like a historian would explain what an agent is doing by telling a story about it. Mm-hmm. And so you can ask, what kind of story is told by this event? You know, if it's a total bizarre kind of thing that means just to enrich the person or something like that, well, there might be something fishy here. Might be from the wrong side and so forth. So you can do that kind of evaluation, and can go at length about that. But the other question is, you can say, let's leave alone minor miracles and angels. They are fine as far as it goes, but if you want a miracle that authenticates your faith, you need a major miracle that is one that only God can work, that needs an infinite agent, that needs somebody who is omnipotent. And those would be, that would be a longer question to pursue. I gave that talk at NYU, actually. These are basically analogous to creation, what it takes for an act of creation. No angel can create, basically. So Thomas Aquinas spells that out in a number of ways, but that would be a longer topic to look at in detail. So yes, angels can work miracles, but they wouldn't be precisely the cases I would look for if I want to make a case for the faith in the first place. They might derail naturalism, for sure, you know, but it doesn't go all the way, you know, if you want to say here's evidence for our faith.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I have a question about this using, the eyewitness, mm-hmm. the consideration of an eyewitness. So the psychologist would say, oh, well, we can be mistaken, mm-hmm. right? There are optical illusions. Mm-hmm. Two people can see two different things, you know, where really there was some sort of reality that actually happened, and you thought you saw it one way, but it was different. You know, memories can be distorted,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
You can make that argument. And, or that psychologists could make that argument. And so then I guess my question is, if you mentioned how, okay, so we can say one eyewitness isn't very convincing, maybe we can write that away. Oh,
mm-hmm.
he just saw it, but it wasn't there. It was a distortion.
Yeah.
But multiple that all say the same thing, such as the liars, it's less likely that
mm-hmm.
somebody's lying when there's multiple, or even just mistaken when there's multiple people that are all mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, so psychologists would also say, okay, well, maybe there's a belief system, or there's a belief that fuels a distortion. So you have a belief that, you know, that you think Jesus is going to resurrect or somehow, or maybe it's even unconscious or something. So I guess my question is, what's the likelihood of that argument? A psychologist trying to make the argument that, well, what if this group of people were all equally psychologically making distortions and that's
right.
how they're mistaken?
Right. So the what you're describing are precisely those kind of laws, right? There are laws according to which people can be deceived.
Right.
And we know that, we can describe that, and we can perhaps identify the conditions under which it happens, and so that's what we can test.
Right.
So you can basically, what you can do is apply another test to this, you know, with the knowledge of the psychologist that you have. And if something like a miracle happens, you should be able to say, this is not something I can explain anymore based on what I know about deceptions and so forth and so on. Now, how could that be possible? Well, I mean, for example, in the case of the resurrection, so you have the eyewitnesses of the apostles. So there are people who have claimed that they were just hallucinating and so forth. That in itself would make the tomb empty, right? So you're not just having the report, you also have the empty tomb with many people being very intent to point out that he's still in there, right? And so in the given scenario, I mean, there's a conglomeration, I mean, like the accumulation of testimony, even hostile testimony, basically. And people don't do that. Rather, they try to explain away, well, they were just stolen or something like that, you know? And so all of these together, that's actually, in the case of the resurrection, it's an interesting kind of tapestry. So if you would try to think you were God and trying to arrange the testimony that it would be available, you couldn't do any better. It's really very tight. It's very interesting. But so I think what you're saying is exactly true, but it's actually more describing the kinds of laws that you would be looking at. Doesn't require people to be infallible or honest or whatever. You know, they can be hallucinating. Hallucination has its own kind of laws. Just to give you another example, for whatever you might think of it, but you know, the miracle of the sun and Fatima. I don't know if you're familiar with that. You know, Catholics tend to be familiar with that case. There were thousands and thousands of people seeing the sun doing these kind of things, right? Dancing around in the sky, approaching and so forth. So many, many eyewitnesses, many of them independent, geographically independent, so it cannot be mass hysteria or something in that sense. The camera lenses of the journalists who were there, capturing it. And you have physical evidence in the sense that it was rain, drenching rain before that, and after that the clothes and the ground was dry, you know, so that it's independent from that. And it is a case of fulfilled prophecy, which is also interesting. So prophecy, fulfilled prophecy is miraculous in a way too, because nobody can know certain kind of events ahead of time, especially if it involves, you know, free decisions of other agents and so forth. Now, if the seers predict that that's going to happen, and it does happen, they can have that knowledge only from God. And that's itself a test that it actually does happen. The Old Testament actually makes that the test, you know, for true prophecy. So, now with all of that, what actually did happen? Did the sun really spin out of its orbit? No, we wouldn't think that. We wouldn't be here, you know. The whole the solar system would be upset and frustrated. So there are, we would assume that has actually happened in the eyes of the beholder, right? And there are such miracles, the apparitions of that sort. I mean, where only the seer sees something, nobody else sees something. That's not itself, that doesn't make it itself non-miraculous. It's still miraculous that it happened in all of these. And that's itself something you can test. So it's basically a test here on the eye, of the eyewitness. And but you have, again, independent evidence to corroborate that that cannot be explained just by something that's intrinsic to this person or that, and by psychology and all that.
So a combination of evidence.
Yes, that's
yeah.
right.
Okay. Mm.
So in that sense, I think we can build a pretty good case.
Yeah.
Mm. Yes.
Father, thank you so much for your talk tonight. Could we return for a moment to your discussion of the metaphysical possibility
yes.
mm-hmm. of miracles, and ask the question really more from an epistemic side, more from our knowing of them? How is it, would you answer, it seems clear how you've answered these scientific realists like Spinoza or Hume, how would you answer those who are not scientific realists, those who don't think that they've landed on real scientific laws, or that they're only describing habits of the mind, and that we wouldn't take into account any upset to those?
Well, for one, Hume himself is one of those. You know, in that sense, it still applies. You know, I mean, perhaps Hume is overstating his case because he is not a realist in that way, you know. I mean, in the sense that, you know, there is such a thing as laws of nature that regulate stuff and so forth. It's not just our habit of observing certain regularities. I mean, Hume is saying precisely that, you know. So all what I've said there would still apply. You know? Further elaboration would, of course, talk about what is a law of nature, and there are different theories about that. So, for example, is a law of nature something that exists separate from reality and that makes certain things happen? Right? That's a weird idea, I think, but we tend to think that way. Or is a law of nature merely our way of summarizing the evidence, you know, in the most clear and uniform kind of way, or most economic kind of way? That question is actually not easily settled, though. So even though we might think it's weird to think that the laws of nature are sort of in a Platonic realm that sort of regulates the scientific data, there must be a reason why we can even describe the data in that way. So you might say it's a convenient way for us to summarize that. But what's the likelihood that they fall into a pattern that we can describe by a mathematical equation? That's totally unlikely. That's a case of intelligent design, if you ask me. That's not self-understood. We don't see, I mean, the intelligent design doesn't explain things that the scientists cannot explain. It explains why the scientists can explain a thing that the scientist explains. Why do physicists have the laws of nature available just to explain certain things? That's not self-understood. So I wouldn't say there's a Platonic realm of laws, but there's a kind of a design. Now, where you locate the design, that's a further kind of question. Is, you know, Newton actually knew about it. I mean, he was aware of that. He said it requires God as the lawgiver, basically. Newton was a theist. He made arguments for the existence of God from his physics. But you can also try to do Aristotelian accounts where you talk about the nature of things and so forth. That's another question that we don't need to get into. But certainly, the argument you're making depends a bit on which theory you are arguing with or against. You know? But I don't think it affects much of what I said earlier. Mm-hmm. Yes, please. Mm-hmm.
Well, my question has to do with miracles of healing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the New Testament, Jesus heals the paralytic. He delivers people from demons. He raises people from the dead. He performs all of these miracles.
Mm-hmm.
Still happening in the world and even in America.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question is maybe not so academic as more emotionally driven, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, what do we say to people who pray for miracles for the people that they love, and the hoped for miracle, the prayed for miracle doesn't happen? And what is God doing there? Or how do we, I am a Catholic, so I accept God's will, and I accept that God is God. You can't make God do things, but you know, that's just a really hard thing. A lot of people reject God because they prayed for a miracle,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't turn out the way that they hoped. They lost the one they loved.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, I'd like to hear you talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Yeah, this is, I mean, this, people talk about the theodicy question, you know, why does, if God is good and almighty, why do bad things happen? And that's a question that is never easy to answer. I think ultimately why people are atheists. You know, if you press atheists with their arguments, there isn't much there. It comes back to that point. And I would never ridicule that, because I think that's a question we're all struggling with. Whether we believe us or not, you know, that's an existential question we all have. And I think, you know, our faith would predict that we are struggling with that. It's not against our faith. It's part of, you know, the struggle perhaps God wants us to be in. For some reason, we might not always understand either. But you're quite right that the question of miracles sharpens that. You know, so if God can work miracles, it's even more obvious that he could do something about it. You know, if you just say you have a God who is far and remote and he sets this clockwork of the universe and the laws of nature into motion, and he never engages it again, then we wouldn't expect something to happen, right? But if you believe in a God who is a personal God who can work miracles, yes, that makes the point, of course, more dramatic then. Now, a bit of that depends on what we think miracles are meant to do. So Jesus certainly in his lifetime healed many people, but he didn't heal all. You know? Maybe that wasn't the point for why he came. Right? In fact, he himself died, suffered. You know? So he wasn't quite the Messiah that perhaps some expected. You know? And I think it's part of our faith to think that there's some anticipation of what Jesus came to establish, namely the kingdom of God, but that the fulfillment will be in the heavenly Jerusalem. Now, in the heavenly Jerusalem, everybody will be healed. Everybody will be resurrected. Everybody will be transfigured, just as Jesus was transfigured. For Aquinas, that's actually a case of a miracle, too. There will be all these qualities that we find in particular instances in the Gospels, but also in our life, I think. So they actually have a meaning in showing us where it's basically ultimately going. But we are nevertheless still in the in-between stage. And so that means we are in a stage that is where we are asked to carry our cross, that's part of our faith, and where things don't happen automatically. I think that's... If we... Let's say God would answer any kind of prayer for whatever kind of healing that we want, right? We would stop doing medicine, mm-hmm. would stop developing virtue to avoid, you know, cancer or smoking or something like that. There are a lot of things we do just because we have to struggle with certain things. But there's also an element in which we would never develop the trust in God, which is something we have to do over and over again. Faith grows in that trust. And sometimes it grows in the midst of not understanding why something is happening. That's perhaps as close as I can get. I mean, the whole theodicy question is a big one, but in the case of miracles, that's perhaps what I would say. C.S. Lewis, whom I mentioned earlier, he has an interesting taxonomy of miracles, how they reverse certain things or anticipate certain things. That would be interesting to look at too, but I cannot do that right now. But so yeah, that's perhaps what I would try to say. Mm-hmm.
In one of my classes earlier today, we were reading Richard Dawkins' *The God Delusion*, the first few chapters, and he cites an experiment that was done where to test the efficacy of prayer, where there were two groups who were undergoing the same surgery, and one of the they had some church congregations who didn't know these people pray for one group, and no one prayed for the other group. And there was no difference in the outcome of
mm-hmm.
any of the surgeries.
Mm-hmm.
And at first when I read that, I thought, well, so there's a lot of religious claims that are not empirically demonstrable or something like that, and we have to accept a certain amount of supernaturalism, and that wasn't a threat to me, but it's, you know, to someone who's a naturalist, that would be pretty devastating. But it sounds like from what you were talking about with the paradigms and what that actually, like, this kind of evidence, it isn't as threatening as even I thought it was, I guess. That it actually contributes to the order that miracles break. It doesn't actually, because I think, and it also goes back to what you were just saying about, we shouldn't be expecting a miracle to happen in every case.
That's right.
But that God allows the order to remain and also performs miracles.
Yes. Those studies that Richard Dawkins mentioned, there are actually many more.
Mm.
And they have now meta-studies of these studies, sort of assessing them cumulatively and all that. And it seems that it's inconclusive, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there are studies that seem to show that prayer is efficacious and some are indeterminate and so on. Now, in a way, if God is the way we have been talking, you shouldn't expect that to work like a mechanism, you know. And in a way, if I were God and say, "You're trying to test me here," I'll show you, you know, that you're putting God to the test, really. So it's not like a slot machine where you put in a coin and then you have the result, and predictably or something like that. Now, even if cumulatively, you know, the evidence is not clear, that doesn't mean that you cannot still pray for that.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows whether your case is not the one case where it works.
Yeah.
So, it is a bit of a strange case in the first place to put God to the test in that way. You know, but they're really strange studies indeed, where people even have tried to test retroactive prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So you pray for an event in the past, you know. That's you have put in your exam and so forth, and it's done. And you pray, God, let me have done well on the exam. Well, God could have known in the past that you're not praying now, and so therefore you could have brought that about. So in that case, logically speaking, that could work. And that study actually showed that it happened. There was one study, you know. It's strange. Something else I wanted to say, but to your question, but I cannot think right now. Yeah, other questions? Yes, please.
When Jesus was asked why he did miraculous things, miraculous works, what miracles, he said it was so that you might believe.
Mm-hmm.
If that's true, and if every time a saint is canonized, there's a miracle required that's scientifically substantiated for to become blessed and another one to become saint, do you think the church should have more of an emphasis, or even have an obligation to publicize these miracles if it was good enough for Jesus to use these as evidence of his authenticity as God? Why do you think the church doesn't promulgate a lot more information and use miracles in their preaching?
Maybe it's a matter of prudence or not wanting to be sensationalist, but on the other hand, I think you're right. I mean, there's probably more that should be talked about. And some of these things are well documented. I mean, like particular healings, say by Fulton Sheen or John Paul II, you know, in the recent canonization processes. I mean, you can find those. My problem with that is if I want to show it to other people, you find things on websites and things like that. But I find it harder to access an actual academically written documentation of that evidence. There is probably more if you look at the Shroud of Turin or Our Lady of Guadalupe, although even there I have not found much that writes it up in that way, but what I did find is very astonishing. and nobody seems to be able to deny that either. So, but I think that indeed should be more publicized. And Father Robert Spitzer, the Jesuit, I mean, he's very adamant about that. You know, so people think that science and faith are incompatible or something, but he says it's the opposite. You know, science demonstrates the faith in so many ways and then shows so many things that are not explicable to to a naturalist kind of a worldview. One of the things he is actually highlighting is near-death experiences. Though near-death experiences, you know, which you think that are individual cases, there are so many of them that there's a whole literature now, medical peer-reviewed literature and medical journals about these experiences and the statistics of that and so forth. And people have experiences that you cannot explain if you're a materialist. So people are drifting out of their body, they're clinically dead, blind people, right? For the first time in their life, they see. They see what's going on in the operation room. They drift out of the room. They go to the neighboring rooms. They hear what people say there and many other kind of things. And you can test. You look at that afterwards. There's another kind of test, right? And it's true. Now, how would they be able to know that? Right? And there are other kind of facts about that. So that can sort of derail a bit like the kind of reductionist view of reality that people have. You know, that's medical scientific literature. So yes, you're right, I think, you know, I mean, there's probably more we should publicize. With, you know, care and prudence, obviously.
I've been sitting here for a long time trying to figure out what I don't get about this talk.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that's really nagging at me is that there's only a very small portion of this talk actually had to do with the definition of what a miracle is.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that I heard it explained, it was what a definition, it was a St. Augustine.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it's just a rare event that happens that can't be explained by science,
mm-hmm.
that happens to be providential. It's good for you. That seemed to be the definition. I could be wrong. My question for you is, on this definition, how is a miracle different from any event that science can't explain at the moment? And why is this not more of a statement of human ignorance than it is a statement of
Providence? It's another thing I didn't get to. You're right. That is a question. And now, it's not that, you know, past ages have been ignorant about that. That's a problem. And Aquinas, for example, does distinguish that. He says, for ignorant people, perhaps they don't know science, that they think magnetism is a miracle or something like that. Now, but that is, I think what we're looking at there is a different thing from a miracle. So if something is only something that we cannot explain yet by science, sure, I mean, some people will say then the God of the gaps. So we don't know where thunder comes from, there's the thunder God doing that, you know? So atheists like to make that point. But here's the difference. The difference is, if something has a natural explanation, we should expect it to happen regularly under certain specified conditions, and you should be able to observe it more often. Miracles are not of that kind. No. So the phenomena that you would look for a scientific explanation have to do with regular natural kind of features. Now, it could be that there are certain natural features that we are not able to explain, and so some people will then perhaps to appeal to the God of Thunder. That's mythology, that's not a miracle. Mythology and miracle are different things. I think one must not mix that. Miracles are unique historical events, you know, if you can establish them. And that's not a matter of not knowing a particular scientific law yet, because if that were a law, you would expect that to happen more often under certain specified conditions. You know, and if you're looking at the kinds of things, I mean, I have tried to do that once. I'm not sure I can do that easily right now, but. And Richard Dawkins has this example of, he says, if you have a statue of the Blessed Virgin Mary, right, and she's suddenly starting to wave at you, right? He says, it's perfectly possible, you know, that all of the atoms suddenly jostle, you know, in one direction, suddenly that makes this waving kind of gesture. I think no scientist would jump to that conclusion. He admits that's so astronomically unlikely, you know, that's ridiculous, but it's logically possible, and therefore that's, for me, okay to assume that. I think from a scientific, any scientist would look for a cause for that. And if the scientist cannot find the cause, then you're dealing with a miracle. It's not, and if there were an unknown hidden law of nature that we haven't explained yet, you would expect such things to happen more often. And not just to statues of the Blessed Virgin Mary, but also to Winston Churchill and Julius Caesar and so forth. And it doesn't. You know.
I guess the trouble with that seems to be happens, I mean, there's been a big growth in this science of complexity in recent decades, and the impact of rare events, and I think that has something to say about this idea of there should be more regularity, but actually in a lot of these different fields, they are irregular, unpredictable, emergent, and rare events happen and have huge impacts that aren't necessarily predictable or explainable.
Yeah. Why would we then not happen to witness that more often? I mean, in ordinary life.
Why wouldn't you witness?
I mean, if such extraordinary things happen on just random little things, let's say on the subatomic level or something like that, right? Then why would not more statues wave at you, basically? The regularities that you, the irregularities that you're appealing to have a particular role, and they can be described by science, but they are not what explains the miracles. They explain the normal operations of nature. Maybe I don't understand you.
We're disconnected here.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Or you can talk later more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I was sitting here listening to this gentleman's question,
mm-hmm.
which is what I was pondering during your presentation. And you talked about individual, unique, inexplicable events. So unique means it's one of a kind.
Mm-hmm.
But you use plural events. There's more than one event.
Mm-hmm.
You use the new paradigm. And I assumed you were talking about the fact that because there were plural events, singular and not similar, that
mm-hmm.
occur, that we can say this is a paradigm. We know based upon witness, i.e. atheists, agnostics, Buddhists, whoever, have also observed the event and said they have no explanation.
Mm-hmm.
Scientists have no explanation. So then that becomes a paradigm. Each individual miracle, I'm giving the term anomaly because it's an occurrence that is different from the current paradigm and must be repeated in order to replace the old paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
In this instance, I've formulated that you said that it's the collection of uniqueness together
mm-hmm.
that can allow us to justify a belief that uniqueness can occur in an event.
I'm not quite sure that I can exactly
answer,
but Yes. But I mean, they're still described by laws of nature for the scientist, you know. So in that sense, they can be categorized and typified. I mean, or the theory of science they have their own fights about that. But yes. So, but if you're talking about anomaly, you said, I mean, then you have to repeat the test, which is not what you would say.
Well, when I say something like rare event.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of an example. There are many. This stock market crash
mm-hmm.
is a rare event.
Yeah.
You don't know. You have the idea that it follows certain laws, but you can't predict it.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally unpredictable when it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
In hindsight, you can make up stories about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
There are all sorts of events like this in science and complexity. There, in biology and physics and stuff like that, they all have their own example of these sort of anomalous things that happen. That it doesn't mean that they didn't have physical causes.
Yeah. Again, I should have had half an hour more to get through that. But it's so it's not just about the anomaly. It's not that there's a statistical outlier or something like that. So, for example, if the statue of the Blessed Virgin Mary were to collapse, right? I think it would be more likely to say that's an anomaly. Because it would be just a case of entropy of a certain kind, because the shape of the statue is, in terms of entropy, anomalous in the first place. And miracles, so one would have to distinguish between anomalies down or up, basically. So down is always more likely. We will find a statue collapsing to be more likely. You know, statues perhaps do that even sometimes, you know. But a statue waving, that is something I don't know how to quickly explain it, but it's a gesture that's meaningful, that expresses a certain kind of purposivity, something that would go with a narrative. And that's how we read it. And we read it as something that is fulfilling a certain kind of actualization of a particular teleology, of a particular intention that somebody would have. That is not something we would explain in the same way. Now again, I would have to make that case a bit more at length to really make that clear. But so that's why I would say, and that was part of the definition that for which you were asking, is it's not just a violation of a law of nature. It's not just an interruption. It's not just an anomaly. It is something that is beyond the powers of a particular agent. Right? So something that an agent couldn't do on its own. So in that sense, it's a variation upwards. You know, it's not a form of entropy. And I think that would be regardless of, you know, how statistically anomalous that is. So that's as good as I get right now. So I wanted to show that it is rational to believe in miracles regardless of whether you have had that experience, right? So it doesn't mean that you can make somebody a believer by showing how it is rational. So the atheist doctors in Lourdes, for example, they don't necessarily convert. And in fact, you know, Emile Zola, you know, the French writer, sort of an atheist at the end of the 19th century, he wanted to debunk Lourdes, and he went there, right, to write about that, make a caricature of that, and make his observations. He was faced with a first-class miracle right in his face, right there. Didn't change a thing about him, right? That doesn't mean that it is not still rational to believe in miracles. You know? So, I mean, even if all the rational evidence is in, people might refuse to believe. So that's not what I mean by rational, that people would be convinced. You know? Pascal says that God always gives enough evidence for those who seek, but not enough evidence for those who are disinterested or don't want to find. So, but the principles, you know, on which that is, that would still be true.